This is your Uncle Don here with my Porcupine Petting Zoo number 311 on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia. After 18 days of traveling, my wife and I are back in old Prince George. Well, old to me as I lived here for 34 years, but not old compared to where we've been. We flew to Lisbon via Frankfurt to join a week-long riverboat cruise up the Douro to the Spanish border. I had an opportunity while killing time in the German airport to buy two coffees at a McCafe, the name itself a hideous mixture of two languages. While there, I bought two cups using four languages in a six-word order. Zwei Kaffee, ein regular, ein grande, globalization. On the trip, we also bought some carbonated bottled water bearing the English inscription, "Feel the unique giggly of natural carbon dioxide." That made us giggly. We spent two nights in a splendid hotel in Lisbon, giving ourselves a day to explore the city. I was impressed, not a mental state I enjoy often. Our hotel faced a major park, one so large that we got lost in it more than once. While we visited, workers were setting up stalls in the park for a coming book fair. It seems that Portuguese still read, even with the blight of television. The city was clean, the people polite and laid back compared to North Americans. English is mandatory in their schools from grade one, so most young people are reasonably fluent in our language, making unilinguals like myself feel inferior. They enjoy their parks and monuments. Their value-added tax, akin to our GST, is 20%, but it's apparent that their government uses the revenue for public purposes. They actually hire humans to clean public spaces. As we happened to be in Lisbon for their Independence Day, we spent a couple of hours watching a parade in the heart of downtown. It appeared that any three people could form an interest group and join in. Among the usual fraternity societies, drummers, and bands, there were those advocating gay rights, immigrant rights, more hospitals, political parties, and most anything else you could think of. There were actually those parading under, horror of horrors, banners with the hammer and sickle. Everyone seemed good-natured, with only minor heckling of one politician running in a pending election. He was not accompanied by goons wearing shades and little ear thingies like our own dear Stephen Harper when he visited Times Square. This politician was protected within a large cordon of fabric that appeared to be carried by protesters, just one of the many surprises revealed by this most civilized of countries. In the immediate wake of our parade came the street sweepers, cleaning up the political tracts and assorted detritus of the passing horde. Their National Day celebrates the date in 1974 when they overthrew the 30-year dictatorship of Salazar, a fascist of the stripe of Spain's Franco. The revolution was carried out without a shot being fired and the empire dissolved. Reconciliation of opposing factions was carried out relatively well. Portugal is now a functioning democracy within the European Union. After that free day, we joined our group for a bus trip to Porto, where we boarded our ship. For the next week, we made short hops up the river, traversing three locks, the highest of which was an impressive 75 meters, the biggest in Europe. The ship was built long and thin to barely fit within the locks. I was able to stand on deck and touch either sidewall. Meals on board were ample, so it took an effort to control my urge to pig out. Breakfast and lunch were buffet style, with dinners formal. Wine glasses were refilled when down to half-mast, again requiring severe restraint. I had no desire to precipitate a horror show such as I have been known to do. Ask my wife about our first date. Ask any one of my former school roommates. At one delightful little town, our entire tour was served dinner at its best hotel. Each circular table for 10 sported a forest of glasses, 5 to a setting, only one of which was for water. More of my restraint was called forth. From my perspective, Portuguese are like most foreigners in that they don't know how to drink coffee. They don't percolate or filter drip grounds as we do, but sip those wee espresso couplets. Fortunately, our cruise was peopled mostly by those who understand the best vehicle for caffeine is a large mug of the good hot stuff. It did take some persuading to get the staff to omit milk, but they could be trained, unlike the Cubans of my experience. From 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., there was a machine in the lounge dispensing a passable coffee, including a decent cup of the black stuff. This device carried a display with a message for impatient consumers. It said, "Take a relaxed moment." I guess that was to prevent those in need of a caffeine fix from whacking it. My overall impression of Portugal was positive. The country's not rich in resources, being one of the poorer ones in Western Europe, but they've developed a good public infrastructure with efficient trains running on time, public education that educates, and a social safety net that appears to work. Their cities are clean, and their citizens, at least the ones we met, were civil when not driving. Well, no one is perfect. Public walls are amply decorated with imaginative graffiti, which they deal with by dismissing it as a passing fad in urban art. While urban youth express themselves by spray painting walls, it appears their rural counterparts are reduced to constructing rambling fences of shale without obvious function. Of course, our tour did not visit the worst areas, but the most scenic and historic. While on the train between Lisbon and Sintra, a beautiful little town of castles, palaces, and assorted tourist traps, we passed through depressing suburbs of high-rise apartments and scrubby little allotments where people grew vegetables in impossible places. Although we didn't see any we could identify as homeless, just a few opportunistic beggars hanging around tourist spots, there were the poor outside of the affluent city centers. We spent our last 3 nights in a fancy hotel in Oriente, a district of Lisbon's outskirts containing buildings erected for the 1998 World's Fair. When I first saw these structures, it occurred to me that we could not find the like in Canada, as a good snowfall would collapse most of these soaring creations. The massive train and bus station was so huge that we got lost within it more than once. I've never seen the like of this area for impressive architecture, parks, and restaurants. The following incident happened in a supermarket within the largest shopping mall I've ever visited. We were in a checkout line behind a couple who ran up a bill of about 20 euros. They tendered a credit card, which was rejected, then another, and another. Between them, they had only 10 euros in change in cash, so they had to leave without their groceries. Until then, it had escaped me that, beneath the apparent affluence and glitter of the shops and well-dressed shoppers, there lay the same desperation of maxed-out debtors that fuels our current recession. There's no way to estimate the wealth of our fellow travelers, but none were poor, as the trip was expensive. We couldn't tell who was above financial worries and who went into hock for a rare fling, but most of us were retired and above the fray facing so many people today. But for a week, we were able to forget financial realities. Now we're back to our disparate realities with time to digest our experiences. It was fun. Having been away from Prince George for over a fortnight gave me a chance to see our town with renewed vision. The first thing I noticed was our litter. In spite of apparent affluence with monster homes and oversized cars, we don't seem to have the will to clean up after ourselves. For decades, our politicians have competed with each other, advocating reduced taxes and government spending. Litter in the streets and highways, homeless sleeping in doorways, and lineups at food banks are obvious results of our reluctance to contribute to the common good. Out of sight, we've quietly dismantled regulations and laws meant to control irresponsible corporate and private greed. We've cheered the success of executives taking home barely taxed millions skimmed from shady financial transactions. Those of us owning homes have exulted in the rise of potential sales values, many borrowing against paper values to finance frivolous consumption, like overseas cruises, perhaps. Only now, with collapse of iconic institutions, which so recently appeared to be towers of wealth, can we see how hollow has been the pyramid of artificial riches. Only when those outfits display their rot do we realize that the real wealth of a nation is built upon its natural resources, the ingenuity and education of its people, and the strength of its political institutions. Here in Canada, we retain that frontier mentality that our country is endless. We continue to give corporations a free hand to rape the land. Anything is justified if it creates jobs. We herd children through underfunded schools, which are pressured to squeeze out graduates like toothpaste from a tube, whether they learned or not. We hardly try to ameliorate huge disparities of wealth, even celebrating huge rewards far above any reasonable return for talent or effort. What individuals or political parties have a program to orient government with the new economic realities? I see none. The road to election is a promise of rapid restoration of the status quo ante. Soon housing will boom, stock markets will resume their march toward the stratosphere, Fossil fuels will remain plentiful and real incomes of the masses will rise. What's wrong with this picture? It is wrong-headed, flat-out case of denial. We face a confluence of factors which should tell us that we cannot resume our old ways. Economists cannot agree on where we are going, but there is an apparent consensus that we will recover, whatever that means. Various letters of the alphabet are dredged up to illustrate the path of this elusive recovery. Learned folks speak of the future in terms of an L, a V, or a double-dip W. My reading of events tells me that we face a new reality, never again to see that debt-financed apparent affluence of the late 20th century. All but the most doctrinaire admit that the world's climate is changing. Hotter, colder, whatever, changes will affect the ability of the planet to provide food for 6.5 billion inhabitants, with a projected peak of 9 billion. Malthus was right, just his timing was off, as he didn't foresee how technology could expand agricultural production. But with deserts expanding and erosion having taken a good half of our prairie's precious topsoil, a peak in food is in sight. We like to pretend that fossil fuels will be with us in abundance forever. For all the innovation and extraction of oil and gas, they aren't making the stuff anymore. We have several centuries of coal and perhaps tar sands bitumen in the ground, but the environmental cost of extracting them is daunting. With oil and gas production flattening and demand growing, there won't be enough to go around. Nations, most notably China and the United States, are already securing supplies of these fuels around the world, fencing them off from world markets. As shortages appear, at best, rationing will result. At worst, wars. Then there's the worldwide exhaustion of potable water. Disputes over supplies are causing extreme hardships, and this is one root of the ongoing cold-hot war between Israel and Palestine. While we fret over the tangible effects of population increase, resource depletion, threatened agriculture, and rising sea levels, there's an invisible elephant in the room that gets too little attention. This is the massive accumulation of debt, public, private, and corporate, around the planet. Beyond a certain amount of debt, debt is needed to lubricate the wheels of commerce. Debt is a hidden cancer, growing invisibly within the social organism. While governments, most notably Obama's America, are covering private and corporate debt with public funds, borrowed funds, they cannot make it just disappear. Today's debts will be paid in the future in one of two ways. Either the labors of future generations will be diverted from consumption to paying it down, or debt will be dissolved by inflation. Romania found itself heavily indebted to foreigners, and the then dictator, Nicolae Ceausescu, repaid that debt by sweating his people. The country extracted itself from the debt pit, but the economy was ruined and the people impoverished in the process. Zimbabwe is a recent case of extraction through inflation. Debt was paid off by running the printing presses, at one point cranking out $100 trillion notes. The result, like Romania's, was collapse and poverty. It appears that Western governments are hoping for at least a temporary respite by charting a course between these two extremes, exemplified by Romania and Zimbabwe. Inflation is targeted at a gradual 2%, meanwhile seeking sources of income to generate government surpluses without sparking rebellion amongst the affluent is a narrow, slippery path to tread. The governor of Texas implied that the Lone Star State might seek secession from the Union to escape the onerous burden of federal taxation. A right-wing-sponsored Tea Party was triggered by Obama's proposal to increase taxes for those taking home, and I deliberately avoid saying earning, over $250,000 a year. This massive, onerous, oppressive tax increase scheduled for 2011 would see the top bracket of American income tax rise from 35% to a whole 39.6%. This would cripple a recipient of $300,000 to a tune of $34.62 per week if he or she did not utilize any of the numerous loopholes allowing exemptions from taxable income. Americans conveniently forget that the top bracket for federal taxes, starting at $250,000, was 92% in 1949. With such withering taxes, the country enjoyed strong growth. Meanwhile, it's time to begin paying down the overhang of debt by restoring a tax regime which will trim the lifestyles of the rich in order to save the entire system. The wealthy would scream, and their tame think tanks would crank out arguments for those discredited trickle-down theories. But society as a whole is at stake here. High income taxes, new wealth taxes, elimination of loopholes, and attack on overseas tax havens would be in order. Is it naive to even think of such politically unacceptable solutions? Perhaps. But do we want to face reality or follow Tinkerbell economics, proposing that all will be well if we just believe in fairies? I'm glad that I'm not young. I'll not have to deal with the daunting, perhaps excruciating choices that my grandson will have to face. My generation, the North American war babies of the 40s, have been the most spoiled cohort ever to infest the planet. We benefited from well-funded public education, with ample employment opportunities and jobs where one earner could support a family. Our water and air were purer, our foods more wholesome and unadulterated. Our cities were less crowded, and services were better funded. We believe this stuff fed to us in the Sunday newspaper supplements, promising a future of 20-hour work weeks, flying cars, and homes where robots performed all the menial jobs. Food would be pills, and everyone could commute easily to work from their sylvan retreats. Bullshit, all of it. Oh, yes, we have the technology. Our streets are filled with iPod zombies and cell phone addicts. Our cars have all the gadgets to entertain us while stuck in traffic jams. Airplanes can whisk us at near supersonic speed between different distant points while we're stuffed like brood chickens into miniature seats. Huge flat-screen television sets fill monster houses, fulfilling the dream of having 57 channels with nothing on. Our children are entertained with imaginative three-dimensional games as parents are afraid to let them play outdoors due to air pollution and predators. We have access to plastic bottles of drinking water as we no longer trust the stuff from the tap. We have a medical system that can repair the heart valve of a fetus in the uterus while we sit in a wheelchair on a waiting list for a hip replacement. Am I a pessimist or a realist? And are we into a time when there's little difference between the two? Okay, today is election day in Prince George. Get out and vote early and often. But if you haven't decided who the good guys and the bad guys are, go to the casino or mall work. Don't muddy the waters by voting without conviction. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. My wife and I have visited Cuba several times over the years. We love it in spite of our dislike of extreme heat. We've gone as tourists, both independently and in a bird-watching group. I spent 2 weeks as a brigade volunteer pruning orange trees on a cooperative orchard. I heartily recommend the country to anyone, but if you want to go and see a country that is not just inexpensive, pleasant, safe, and welcoming, you'd better go fast. President Obama threatens to allow American tourists to infest the island. One of the advantages of Cuba has been the lack of groups of Americans. There are lots of Canadians, Italians, French, and other Europeans, but precious few Yanks. Now, some of my best friends and late relatives are or were Americans, but mobs of them as tourists will surely spoil the uniqueness of the culture. By all means, visit Cuba, but do it fast. Several decades ago, long before television landed in households, radio was the medium of the day. In the New York area, most Sunday newspapers carried a uniform colored comic section. Back then, there was a popular fellow carried by many radio stations every Sunday morning. His name was Uncle Don. This Uncle Don read the comics panel by panel to hundreds of thousands of preliterate children. One morning, after reading each of the comics to the little ones, he made an unfortunate comment, thinking his microphone was switched off. He offhandedly said to his engineer, "I guess that'll take care of the little bastards for another week." That went out over the airwaves, and Uncle Don disappeared forthwith. Google Uncle Don, and you'll come up with multiple explanations that this is an urban legend and it never happened. There are some things that we take on faith without proof, religions being the prime example. I take the Uncle Don legend on faith, and I will defend it for the same reasons that people believe in their religions, because I want to. So there. The legendary Uncle Don is the role model which I admire. I will defend his existence, and in fact, for the first few of my shows on this station, I concluded with his line, "I guess that will take care of the little bastards for another week." I dropped this as it required a lot of explaining to the uninitiated. With the warming climate, the Arctic Ocean is losing its ice cover, making undersea resources accessible. There's a mad scramble among nations bordering on that ocean, each claiming chunks of the seabed as their own. Russia, the United States, Denmark, Norway, and Canada each has its own maps, with declared properties overlapping. This came to public attention with the Russians having planted their flag under the North Pole. There's a dark horse in this race with a solid claim. Every kid knows this, but few adults do. Look at all the gifts under the Christmas tree, gifts that come from Santa's North Pole workshop. Read the box, product of China. I've broadcast weekly as Uncle Don on this station for 7 years. Somewhere along the line, it was picked up for rebroadcast on CJLY in Nelson and CHLS in Lillooet. I was amazed to find that I have regular listeners on these stations. There have also been those picking up my shows from radioforall.net and live streaming on cfur.ca. Just last week, I received a bit of fan mail from a listener in Minnesota. How and why he found me is a mystery. Here in Prince George, my rants have inspired Doug Strachan to develop his own presentation, which he calls Common Sense, generally coming from the right, countering my leftist slant. After 311 shows in 364 weeks, I'm tired and I find myself repeating. On my first shows, I railed against the pending American invasion of Iraq and have consistently criticized George W. Bush on all of my shows. George has retired to his ranch, and we now have a man at the helm of the USA, who I hesitate to criticize until he's had a fair chance to prove himself. Of course, there's still our own blessed Stephen Harper and his bum boys like James Moore and Stockwell Day, but these guys are generally beneath contempt when it comes to their influence on world affairs. The predations of Gordon Campbell barely warrant a ripple beyond British Columbia's borders. In essence, it's time for me to retire, or at least take a sabbatical. I'll take advantage of time freed up by not having to prepare scripts, pursuing other voluntary activities, and performing the chores of summer required in our semi-rural property. I encourage anyone to take up my cudgels and carry on with a weekly commentary on these stations. I warn you, this takes a lot of time to research current events and their backgrounds, time to write scripts and edit them. As one needs a patient and one needs a patient partner to listen to the raw scripts and offer constructive criticism. As for me, I've had a captive audience and an understanding wife who has indulged me. I thank CFUR and its station manager, Christopher Earle, for supporting my programming and faithfully copying shows on CD for some followers who cannot get me on radio or computer. I thank CHLS and CJLY for rebroadcasting my programs. And I don't want to forget Doug Strachan, who's been assiduous in keeping me on track, criticizing me when needed. I welcome comments from those who have listened to these shows over the years. I can be reached through this station or via email at toadhill@magnet.com. That's toadhill@mag-net.com. Listener comments, or lack thereof, will be a big factor in my decision whether or not to resume Uncle Don's shows in the fall. If you care, write. This concludes the 311th edition of Uncle Don's Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia. Get out there and enjoy the summer. Read, listen, and think. And remember what I learned in the U.S. Army. Never believe anything you hear and only half of what you see.